Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Bite marks, fingerprints, and shoe prints, blood, urine, DNA. This hour, we want to talk about advances in forensic science. We'll discuss how better practices are improving the analysis of all kinds of forensic evidence used in investigations. And joining us to start off our conversation, she'll be with us for the entire hour, is Alicia Karikiri. She's director of the Center for Statistics and Applications in Forensic Evidence. It goes by the acronym CSAFE. She's also a distinguished professor of statistics at Iowa State University. Alicia, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Let's start off by making sure we all understand what forensic science is. Remind us of the spectrum of evidence and work that forensic science covers.
Well, forensic science is the study of anything that could be evidence in a crime. That would include fingerprints and shoe prints and determination of the time of death of somebody, of course, DNA. There's a huge variety of types of evidence that may help link a suspect to a crime.
Mm-hmm. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Perhaps forensic science, this treatment of scientific evidence during the course of investigation, has shaped your life, and you'd like to join our conversations. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Throughout the hour, we'll be hearing stories of how forensic evidence helped or hurt investigations. Tell us, Alicia, before we get to some narratives here, about your center's mission, why it was set up, and the progress that you've made so far.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So first of all, our center, the Center for Statistics and Applications in Forensic Evidence, is a partnership of five universities now. Iowa State University is the lead, but we also have partnerships with Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Duke University in North Carolina, the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and University of California at Irvine. The partners are all statisticians, with the exception of Duke, which the principal investigator there is a lawyer. We were set up in 2015 as a NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, Center of Excellence, and our mission is threefold. So, number one, of course, is to carry out research on the probabilistic statistical foundations of different types of evidence. Number two is to engage the forensic scientists and the legal community to understand what the more important problems are, where we can make the most impact and the quickest progress. And number three, to train not only forensic scientists and lawyers and judges, but also the general public on what some of these issues are and what we need to, think about when we're thinking about the evaluation of evidence in the context of some criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm. And in recent decades, we've seen plenty of examples of how forensic evidence is flawed, prone to errors by the way it's treated or collected. Give us a sense of what that is, because it's come into popular culture. We have Netflix true crime documentaries that expose scientists or explore how evidence is misinterpreted by the police and the courts. So what is the real story there? What has been happening in decades past that your center, in part, is trying to correct? What is the length and breadth of the problem?
It's a huge problem. So many of the forensic techniques that that are in use today, and I am going to talk about some pretty popular ones like firearms examination or fingerprinting or you know, bite mark analysis, many of those things that are currently used in court, in reality, arose from practice. You know, somebody said, oh, maybe we can do this. And there was never any scientific development that led to this type of techniques, if you will. So if you ask a firearms examiner, what do you think the error rate in the profession might be? They really cannot give you a very good answer because there has never been a really well-designed, carefully carried out experiment to see, for example, whether firearms examiners are right 95% of the time or 98% of the time, you know, on the average. Mm-hmm. So much of the forensic practice today is not scientific in the sense that there haven't been the experiments behind it that allow us to estimate error rates, to understand what are the difficult cases, what are the, you know, where is it that examiners may find it more challenging, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2009, there was a report by the National Academy of Sciences that was pretty critical of the state of the forensic practice in the United States, and in particular of the type of evidence that's called pattern evidence. So, for example, shoe prints or fingerprints or markings on a bullet from the rifling in the barrel of the gun, anything that leaves a pattern. Those were the ones that the academies established were most prone to subjectivity, where the least amount of data and science had been developed, and that required the most attention. And so CSAFE was created in part as a consequence of that report. That report recommended that an agency like the FDA, that, you know, that looks at what are effective drugs, how should drugs be used, and so on, that a similar agency be created for forensic sciences.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that is being portrayed often in courtrooms by investigators, prosecutors, as science really does measure up to the definition we have of science.
That's exactly right.
Mm. Let me ask you about a specific case, if I can, that our Iowa Public Radio listeners will be aware of. This tragedy that happened in April, a stray bullet striking and killing a young woman, also injuring her boyfriend, driving on Highway 218 in the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area in April. Now, from what I understand, this is still an ongoing investigation. There is a bullet. To my knowledge, no weapon has been recovered. Can you walk us through what you believe would be the knowledge? What can we gain from simply having a bullet fired? And we have a lot of questions surrounding it.
Well, ideally, you would want to also have access to at least some gun that may have fired that bullet so that you could compare test shots from the gun to the crime, to the bullet that was used in the crime. In this case, as I understand it, the police doesn't have any gun at this moment for the comparison, which is really a pity. The only thing I think that can be done with that bullet is it could be entered into a national system called NIBIN, the National Information something something. So this is a system that most crime labs or police departments have, where you can upload images of bullets or cartridge cases. And the system will come back and say, here's 25 bullets that could potentially be matches to the one you have. And so, in principle, one could try to see whether the system comes up with some sort of a potential match that then could tie this crime to another one and, you know, from there see whether there might be some clues to find the person that shot this young people in Waterloo.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a long shot.
right. And also we have a moving car. We have a woodsy areas on one or at least one, maybe both sides of the car. So a big question here that investigators have is, where did that shot come from? Where was the shooter when the rifle went off or the gun went off? So can you tell anything about that through forensic science?
You probably could. This is not the type of investigation we do in our center, but you can look at, for example, at the direction of travel of the bullet, depending on, you know, the direction in which it entered the victim. Given the amount of damage around the wound, you could probably say something about the distance the shooter was from the victim. So there's a few things you can say, but, you know, that is going to be... It's not like you can say anything really definitive about the shooter was standing here and was kneeling or what have you. So there's some clues that can be gained, but not anything that you can use to point to a specific person.
If you just joined us, Alicia Kari-Curry is with us, director of CSAFE, that's the Center for Statistics and Applications and Forensic Evidence at Iowa State University. We're looking at science, the science of forensics, and how that is advancing so that it becomes indeed science used in courtrooms, in investigations. If you have an area of your life that forensic science has touched, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you just have a question about forensic science. Let's say hello to Susan Friedman is with us. She's a staff attorney with the Innocence Project. That's an organization that helps exonerate wrongly convicted people. Welcome to our program, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us briefly about your background and your work.
So I work at the Innocence Project, which is a nonprofit that was founded in 1992 by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. And the goal of our work is to use DNA evidence to exonerate people who have been wrongfully convicted and to prevent future injustice by implementing reforms to prevent these wrongful convictions.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I just wanted to make it clear to people that the number of people who have been exonerated through your organization is huge.
Yeah, so to date, there have been 365 post-conviction DNA exonerations, and our office has been involved in over 200 exonerations.
Many of them on death row.
A number of people have been exonerated from death row as well. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example where a prime example that you would say has things in common with a number of these exonerees where DNA research showed that the person serving time, convicted and serving time, can positively be said not to be the perpetrator?
Sure. So when DNA technology came online, it revolutionized the criminal justice system. And suddenly we were able to connect people to crimes with physical evidence in cases where we previously were not able to. However, it also became clear that this would become a tool to prove that people have been wrongfully convicted as well. And whenever we have a DNA exoneration, one of the things that we do is we want to take a deep dive on that case and see what went wrong in the system, what happened here. And what the numbers show as we analyze case after case is that these aren't one-offs. These aren't problems that are unique to a specific case, but that instead we're seeing patterns where there are a number of systemic factors in the system that are leading to wrongful convictions. And so, for example, some of the things that we see repeatedly in these cases is eyewitness misidentification, false confessions, jailhouse informants, inadequate defense and government misconduct, and as well, misused forensic science. So one case recently in 2018, Eric Kelly and Ralph Lee were exonerated in Paterson, New Jersey. In that case, there was a store clerk who was murdered, and he had been stabbed to death, and it was clear that the video store had been ransacked. two individuals had come in previously, witnesses, and they had seen, they came in separately, and one saw an individual with a baseball cap on his head, and one had seen an individual just covered in blood. It's unclear if they had seen the same person, but two witnesses had reported being in the store shortly before the victim was found and seeing someone in the store. And there had been some chatter in the community, and ultimately Eric Kelly and Ralph Lee were picked up, and they were separately interrogated, and both ended up giving confessions. And remarkably, one of the witnesses had said that they saw a man wearing a purple hat, and Eric Kelly had confessed to being in the store and wearing a hat, and he identified the hat, which was found at the crime scene. At the time, DNA testing was in its infancy, and the FBI was able to do some testing using a process known as DQ Alpha, and what they had found was that Eric Kelly was not the source of the DNA on the hat. Likewise, Lee was also excluded, assuming that there was only one individual whose DNA was left on the hat. But again, this was the beginning of DNA testing, and so they couldn't definitively say that there was only one person on the hat. Well, both men went to trial, and confession evidence is incredibly powerful, and they couldn't overcome those confessions, and they were convicted. In 2010, a judge had ordered DNA testing. At this point, Eric Kelly was represented by Vanessa Potkin from the Innocence Project, and Ralph Lee was represented by Paul Castellero from Centurion Ministries. And in 2014, DNA testing had advanced so significantly that now they were able to identify the unique profile of the person who wore the hat. And when they uploaded that profile to the FBI database, which is a database that maintains profiles and has many different kinds of profiles, but they includes two databases, one that has convicted offenders' DNA profiles in there, and then also evidence from prior, from other unsolved crimes, they ended up with a hit, and the hit was to a man named Eric Dixon, who lived in the area at the time of the crime and had previously attempted to rob a store about a mile away from where this video store was, and he had pulled out a knife, and he only was chased off from the store by some other customers that had come in. And he had just been released prior to this crime taking place. In this instance, after a 9-day hearing, the judge had vacated Eric Kelly's and Ralph Lee's convictions because it was clear that had the jury known that Eric Dixon's DNA was on that hat that was found, I think it was 20 feet from the body, there was no way that these two men would have ever been convicted.
Susan Friedman of the Innocence Project, where she's a staff attorney. Let me turn to Alicia Karikiri of Iowa State University. Now, Susan mentioned patterns in these to date 365 DNA exonerees connected with the Innocence Project. You deal with statistics, of course, Alicia. In what way do you work with this organization, the Innocence Project?
In many ways. But I wanted to add one thing to what Susan was talking about, which is, as Susan was talking about, the fact that these are typically not one-off. And that's absolutely true. And so many of the cases, a series of the cases that Innocence Project managed to undo, the wrongful convictions, those were due to evidence that consisted of bite marks. It has been found that bite marks tend to not be probative in the sense that we think it is. And so many of those cases have been overturned. And other cases that have been overturned have to do with hair analysis. And this was also a sequence of convictions that happened because the probative value of the hair analysis was widely exaggerated by the examiners that testified in court. So many of these forensic technologies are not bad in the sense that they do have some probative value, but oftentimes what has happened is that examiners have exaggerated the conclusions they can draw from the evidence in a specific case. So today, for example, a firearms examiner is no longer allowed to say that this particular gun, to the exclusion of all other guns, fired this bullet or this cartridge case. And so many of those conclusions that used to be so categorical, so strong, are no longer acceptable in court, which I think is a great thing.
Join our conversation as we discuss advances and improving analysis of all kinds of forensic evidence used in investigations with Alicia Karikiri of Iowa State University, Susan Friedman with us of the Innocence Project. Coming up on a break, but let's get Joel Comanche from calling from Comanche, Iowa. I hope I got your town name right. It's been a while since I've seen that name on my screen. Joel, welcome to the program.
It's Jill, J-I-L-L.
Oh, and Jill, hi.
No, it's Comanche. We'll know you're a tourist if you say Comanche.
Okay. Jill, we don't have much time before the break. Tell us what's on your mind in this field.
I just have a question for Alicia regarding, do you do any work with body farms as far as being able to garner information from them that go into your statistical analysis? Mm.
Oh, that's a great question. We do not. So there is a lot of research going on. There's a huge body farm that's maintained, I believe, by the University of Tennessee. But we don't have, that's not part of our scope of work.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jill, from Comanche. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about, Susan, with your work with DNA evidence. We might have to continue this into the second half hour. I'm sure we will, because we only have about a minute left. But when we talk about DNA evidence being sort of set apart in forensics, when it is not reliable, what are the causes when it's unreliable?
So I think there are a few things to keep in mind when we think about DNA evidence. And so the first is that the world is a really messy place. And so as we walk through it, we are depositing DNA everywhere. You know, you open up a door, some DNA comes off your hands from what are known as skin cells or epithelial cells. You're shedding hair. So the first thing that is really important for crime scene evidence technicians to keep in mind and for law enforcement to keep in mind is what is the value of that DNA evidence. So just because someone's DNA is present, we have to make sure that it's actually directly connected to the crime. We have to know there's reason to believe that the perpetrator, the true person who committed this crime, for some reason came into contact with this object and left behind their DNA. So I think that...
We'll have to go to break and pick it up when we come back. Susan Friedman, stay with us, a staff attorney with the Innocence Project. Alicia Karikiri is with us of Iowa State University. Join our conversation if you have a question or experience with forensic science. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about forensic science this hour, how the evaluation of forensic evidence, and this meaning fingerprints, shoe prints, blood, urine, DNA, bite marks, how it's currently flawed, has been for decades. It's prone to errors. And Alicia Karikiri is the director of CSAFE, the Center for Statistics and Applications in Forensic Evidence at Iowa State University, together with a whole bunch of other people, other universities. They're tackling and making better practices, improving the analysis of all kinds of forensic evidence used in investigations. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Also joining us this hour, Susan Friedman, staff attorney with the Innocence Project. Some tremendous work done there. So far, 365 DNA exonerees to date, 20 of whom were on death row. These are people who, through the use of DNA analysis, improved technology and analysis, have been proven to be innocent after convicted and serving some amount of time. Susan, before we took our break, you were telling us about some of the ways in which, well, DNA is sort of set apart, isn't it, in terms of forensic evidence, because unlike a shoe print or a bullet, these things are really scientific when you find DNA. But, and the big but that you were just beginning to talk about, is that I think you said the world is a messy place. Explain what you mean there, how errors can creep in because the world is, in terms of DNA, a messy place.
Sure. Thanks, Ben. So what I was saying before is that we leave DNA everywhere we go. It's coming off of our skin when we touch something. Our hair is shedding. And so our DNA is essentially everywhere. And as DNA testing has advanced from the 80s and the 90s into, you know, where we are today, one of the things that we've been able to do is that these DNA testing kits have become incredibly sensitive, which means that we can now test smaller and smaller quantities of DNA, which is great. However, one of the things that we need to make sure that we're doing is that we are validating these techniques. Now, Alicia can explain, can probably give a full lesson on validation, but the general gist of it is that what we want to make sure is that whatever technique is being used in a laboratory on cases, that the lab has shown that they can that the results that they're getting are repeatable, reproducible, and that they're reliable, that they're getting the same exact result every single time, so that we can feel confident when they come into court and say, yes, this DNA belongs to John Doe, we can be sure that they have the validation studies to support that kind of claim. And so what's critically important is that when they do these validation studies, in light of how sensitive the testing has gotten, that they are doing it on samples, and this is true regardless, but especially true given the power of DNA evidence, that they're doing it on samples that represent what actual casework looks like. And so what I mean by that is, if a lab wants to test a knife handle, let's say that's left, you know, a knife handle from a knife that's been left behind at a crime scene, and that knife, when they bring that in and they swab it and they do the DNA testing, they see that there is DNA from at least three people on that knife, and they're going to try to figure out who those three profiles belong to. They need to be able to show that they've previously done testing in their lab where their analysts have been able to do the same kind of testing and reliably gotten and have been able to produce the correct result. And so although it's a blessing that we can now test smaller quantities of DNA, that also means that we have to be sure that the profiles that we're generating are actually associated with the perpetrator and not possibly left behind innocently. And so that's one of the bigger concerns here.
Mm. Okay, fascinating. Susan Friedman of the Innocence Project. Let's include in our conversation Peter Stout before the hour ends. We have a few minutes left. He's president of the Houston Forensic Science Center, joining us by phone. Peter Stout, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I understand you've been listening in. You have a tremendous amount of experience in forensic science. Why don't you give us very briefly your background and then we'll talk about your expertise in toxicology.
So briefly, my background, bachelor's in biology, master's in engineering, PhD toxicology. I started my career as a naval officer. I was a NARC for the Navy. I ran one of the Navy's drug screening laboratories. Separated from there, ran a commercial laboratory doing workplace drug testing and drug analysis, and then was 10 years at a not-for-profit research institute doing research and accreditation in forensics, and now I've been here in Houston running one of the largest laboratories in the country for about 4 years now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and let's zero in on toxicology. What is meant by toxicology in this context?
So in the crime laboratory, toxicology is typically around driving under the influence of drugs and alcohol or the use of drugs in the commission of a crime. And the main one that we see is what we call drug-facilitated sexual assault, which is the use of drugs as a chemical restraint in sexual assault. So it's all about the impairment during driving. And interestingly, I think driving under the influence of drugs and alcohol is probably one of the most litigated and best defended types of cases out there because lots of people drink, lots of people drive, and it's a place where people have the money to hire defense attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Describe a little bit of your work with Alicia at CSAFE in Ames.
We have a number of projects that we work with the CSAFE group on. Some is around what we call blind testing. We have a system here that we've been pretty aggressive about. We make case materials that are designed to look like cases, and we put them into the system in such a way that the analysts handling them don't know whether they're handling that mock case or they're handling a real case. So we test the system continuously. So I've got one project with CSAFE where they actually have an analyst that is embedded with us to help design those, help manage that system, and help understand better how we're doing that and what might be useful elsewhere. We've got a couple of other studies in latent prints and what it makes for good latent print evidence, and can we assign a value to how good a latent print is to be able to use that for examination. Now, there's a couple of studies that we're looking at in some new technology and how you scan firearms evidence, and also what we call a black box study of sequentially manufactured barrels from firearms to help determine, can examiners distinguish sequentially manufactured barrels from each other in firearms exams. So a number of different projects with them.
Peter Stout, back to toxicology, when we talk about other areas of forensics, fingerprints, shoe prints, blood, bite marks, open to interpretation, can you look back in toxicology and see there was a lot of, well, not quite science going on in the interpretation of toxicology and investigations in the past and currently?
Toxicology has been a discipline that has largely been viewed as more scientific in nature because it comes out of a lot of clinical testing and the chemistry that is behind testing individuals for the compounds that are there. So there's been less question about toxicology than some other disciplines. However, there still is a lot of little unknown things in forensics. Really, very few disciplines can say what their error rate is, because even in toxicology, all of the cases that we get are unknowns. So I can't really say, did I get it right or not? I just know what I measured in that sample. I've got to try and interpret that.
What is it at the top of your list of common errors in the area of toxicology?
The interpretation of the results. What does 2 nanograms per milliliter of tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in marijuana, does that mean somebody was impaired or not? Very difficult to say. I can say that with some certainty for alcohol, but the information behind the scientific literature about how impaired is impaired and what does impairment mean for a lot of other drugs is not nearly as well developed. So there's a lot of potential challenges in that interpretation. And a lot is in just how the testing is conducted. Do I have sufficient control? What does sufficient control mean? How do I determine that number, and what is a standardized way of doing that? There's really very few standards in forensics across the entire country.
Right. So it varies from state to state, however, and perhaps within states it varies depending on the police department.
Yep, it most certainly can. Texas, we actually are pretty fortunate in Texas. We have a very high-functioning forensic science commission. There's a lot more standardization. Texas is one of the few states in the nation that actually has a statutory requirement for the laboratory to be accredited and for analysts to be licensed and certified. That's not the typical circumstance across the whole country.
Peter Stout is with us, president of the Houston Forensic Science Center. Peter, I understand you have an interesting story of how your center came to be. Can you tell us that briefly?
Houston is a unique circumstance. It's part of what brought me here to work with this. Houston has the distinction of a 2003 New York Times headline, the worst crime lab in the country. Houston is internationally renowned for problems that were here in the laboratory when it was under the Houston Police Department. It was underfunded. It was poorly managed. You name it, it was here. And because Houston is a very large metropolitan area, a lot of attention on it. There were some very high-profile exonerations that happened from errors that occurred in the laboratory. So from that, and I've got to give HPD a lot of credit, they were part of creating something different for how the laboratory gets managed. The forensic operations were pulled out of the Houston Police Department and put into a semi-corporate organization, what in Texas we call a local government corporation. So that's what I'm president of. That's why my title is president, because my boss is actually a 9-member board of directors, not the mayor, not the police chief, not the DA. The citizen board that has fiduciary oversight over the laboratory. And that started 5 years ago. So we have been very much on an adventure and a unique circumstance here of what does it really mean to try and remediate a notoriously failed laboratory, but also what does it look like to try and move forensic operations out of a law enforcement agency and into something that is run by scientists and has the objective of objective scientific evidence.
Can you take us back to the worst cases at that crime lab there in Houston? What practices were going on that are just, in your mind, unbelievable?
Oh, there was, frankly, dry labbing, what we call them. There was results that were being fabricated. There was wildly just incompetent work going on. Wrong equipment, wrong people, poor training, poor processes. It really was kind of a perfect storm of all of the potential things that aren't unique necessarily to Houston. We see these in other laboratories. It just happened at a scale here and a visibility that really made it a remarkable circumstance. So two really high-profile exonerations, Josiah Sutton and George Rodriguez, that both served significant time in prison because of laboratory errors. Certainly more things had to happen for them to be wrongfully convicted than just simply the laboratory error, but had the lab not gotten it wrong in the first place, they never would have been in prison. So, the city had to sign large checks in compensation for those wrongful convictions.
To how many people do you think were wrongly convicted because of this poor crime lab in the Houston area?
Well, those are the two highest profile ones. I know there were other cases, and there were quite a few what we call Chapter 64 post-conviction testing cases that came out of Houston. There were dozens, if not hundreds. There have been not quite for some of the same laboratory failures, but we've also had several hundred exonerations here on drug charges because of field tests, those little color tests that are used by officers in the field. That ultimately turned out when the laboratory testing was done that the drugs weren't drugs. They weren't a controlled substance. So there was no basis for those charges. And there have been about 300 of those exonerations here in Houston as well. Mm-hmm. So we've had hundreds of exonerations here from various aspects of forensic sciences that didn't work as we would like it to.
Alicia Karakiri, as we wind up this conversation here in the next 5 minutes, start off by telling me what Peter's center there, the Houston Forensic Science Center, represents in your overall scheme of improving forensics across the country.
Well, first of all, I thank you, Peter, for being here. I will have to say that Peter is running an outstanding operation. And if nothing else, I don't know much about the functioning of the lab itself, but I can say that he has instituted this culture of collaboration with the broader scientific community and going after problems and asking questions. And it has been extraordinary how much cooperation and how wonderful it has been to work with this lab. So I really hope that other labs will pick up this new, new ideas and work with us too. For us, it's critical, Ben, to work with labs because, we are academics in various disciplines, but mostly in statistics, mathematics, computer science. And, of course, none of us has expertise in the forensic sciences themselves. So if we want to come up with meaningful solutions, things that eventually can be transported into practice, research with a mission, if you will, we absolutely need to work alongside the forensic scientists. We it would be a waste of money for us to come up with some sort of method or some sort of analysis that is impractical for whatever reason in the lab. And so as we develop new research ideas, we're always in contact with forensic scientists to make sure that we're addressing things that need addressing, that we're going in the right direction, that this is something that eventually might find its way into practice. Otherwise, we're just another research organization that is just doing research for the fun of research. We want to have a mission here.
Fascinating conversation this hour, Alicia. Is there any way that listeners, citizens not directly involved in forensics can get involved?
I'm glad you asked me that. So one of the things we've been thinking about doing in CSAFE is involving citizens in our science. So much of the research that we do depends on data. For example, on having a very large collection of shoe prints of different brands and sizes and so on which we can develop algorithms to compare them, to quantify the similarities, what have you. And so we've been thinking about ways of involving, this is one example, other examples involve handwriting, many other things. And so we've been thinking of ways of involving citizens, you know, church groups or the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts or what have you, to collect data for us. So the things we're hoping to do in the next year is show up at places such as the Iowa State Fair, and unfortunately we missed this year we were not in time. So show up at the Iowa State Fair or at Boy Scouts or Girl Scout troop meetings or what have you, with kits that we can distribute and send people home and say, this is the way you collect, for example, shoe print information, that they can send back to us. And so maybe high schools are interested in the scientific activities. So if you're listening and you would like, you have ideas on how you might be able to help us out collecting data and doing science, love to hear from you.
Interesting. Peter Stout, back to you. In the short time that we have left, you mentioned marijuana, the active ingredient in marijuana, THC there. Of course, a huge trend among states to legalize recreational marijuana. What do you see as the big challenges in your area of toxicology in determining cannabis impairment behind the wheel? I mean, we're all over the place. Do we have any clue?
This one's you have found a huge issue. One of the things I try to point out to most groups is what we're legalizing in this country, and as we change the prohibition on marijuana, we are not legalizing your neighbor smoking a little pot. We are legalizing a THC processed product containing industry. We have some information about what smoking marijuana means for impairment, for toxicology, for even the analysis of controlled substances. What we have much less information about is what high THC containing products will do and what they mean. It's the difference between getting the vegetable out of the produce section of the grocery store and Cheese Whiz. THC processed products are something entirely different. And I don't know what it means to have high concentration THC doses in a driver with alcohol or another drug. There are some real challenges there. We don't have good methods of detecting impairment at the roadside to be able to establish probable cause to then get the biological specimen.
We can measure. We measure THC at the roadside the way we can measure alcohol blood level?
No, we really can't. And that's part of the difficulty. There aren't good standardized field sobriety tests at the roadside. You know, the walk and turn, can you walk a straight line? There are some good standardized tests that work well for alcohol, but they aren't the same thing for marijuana. And there are hundreds of thousands of breath analysts in the country. There's about 8,000 what we call drug recognition experts, officers that are trained to recognize the signs and symptoms of drug impairment. As marijuana becomes basically the scale of another alcohol, we have a huge amount of work that's got to happen in order to have the ability to identify impairment at the roadside.
Okay. We'll have to call it quits for now. What a fascinating conversation. We could talk for hours on this. Peter Stout, president of the Houston Forensic Science Center, Susan Friedman, an attorney with the Innocence Project, and Alicia Kari-Kiri, director of CSAFE, the Center for Statistics and Applications Forensic Evidence at Iowa State University, all working together to improve our analysis of all kinds of forensic evidence used in investigations. Alicia, Susan, Peter, thank you very much for the informative hour.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Shirley Wong, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Help today also from Stephanie Nobrega. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.